Okay. So what we started was a couple of weeks ago, we did some of it and we said we're going to continue, so we will. And the question was, this week we had a simcha here in Bnei Avram, a wedding, and there is a custom by Jews to stand when the bride and groom go down the aisle. We were wondering a couple of weeks ago what the source for that, if there is, should there be, and we said then at the time that it was quoted that Rav Moshe Feinstein did not stand up when a bride and groom walked down. In fact, Rav Belsky, who writes about this, but he does not write about it in his sefer. I saw someone quote Rav Belsky saying this, even though Rav Belsky quotes that Rav Moshe did not stand. And then someone else quotes Rav Belsky as saying, not printed, that Rav Moshe held that it was a non-Jewish custom. Rise for the bride and groom is a non-Jewish custom. And Rav Moshe held, therefore, since it's a non-Jewish custom, there would be no reason to do it. We did point out a couple weeks ago that this is a custom that maybe to Rav Moshe in Russia, where he was born, White Russia, and that part of the world, it wasn't so popular. Reb Zelig Epstein, my Rebbe, said that when he was younger, he never remembers anyone standing up for the bride and groom. But definitely in the Svarasha world, in Kushta, which is Constantinople, Turkey, in these places, there were serious things brought down in the 1600s and 1700s about rabbis writing this. In the 1600s and 1700s, they used to go from town and they would walk into a town and see no one did it, and they would institute it right away. So clearly, in the Sephardic world, they had this custom. So even if you want to say, not to never chashva minimize Rav Moshe, he's the king, but even to say it became a non-Jewish custom, you could say that in the Sephardic world, they had this custom. And the Litvish world, in the Russian world, they didn't until it got influenced by the Goyim. Maybe that's what he meant. And therefore, he didn't hold it was such a big deal. But again, Rav Zelig Epstein said it as well. He doesn't remember anyone ever standing up for a bride and groom. So we said that when you start looking around, there are multiple potential reasons given why one should stand for a bride and groom. And based on the reasons, some of them, almost all of them have questions on them, which leads more to Rav Moshe's idea that maybe it wasn't such a sourced custom. But again, Svarash custom 300 years ago, write this. But they all quote these ideas. And within each answer, reason provided, you find serious questions. So it could be that, just myself saying that, yes, there is an original source potential to stand up for a chasen and kala, but what it turned into, Rav Moshe held, was a non-Jewish custom based on that, which it just started something real, and then over the time it got just, it overblown, and people, the water's going, and everyone lost control of what they were doing and why they're doing it, and now what they're looking at today looks nothing like the original custom should be, and that's a normal process, sadly, that happens sometimes. They have the famous joke that they were dancing on Simchas Torah, holding the Sefer Torah, when they would get to a certain spot, right near the Aron Kodesh, about like 3 feet before the Aron Kodesh, that a really serious thing, that when they get there, everyone would duck, like bow down to the Aron Kodesh as you get within the realm of seeing the Aron Kodesh. And it became a custom, and everyone would do it. They would go around Sefer Torah, everyone would get to that place and like do the bow. And we discussed, I think, a couple of years ago on how the Vilna Gaon held that you're supposed to sing somber music because the Simchas Torah might be the end of Rosh Hashanah and Kippur. Here they were bowing down. And one guy decided to investigate what is going on, why this spot. And he found out that years earlier there was a water pipe that went there and before they had redone the place. Everyone used to bow down and became accustomed. There's definitely some concept like this where you have to know the makar of a minhag to understand how good it is. Now, usually the source for a minhag, if you look around enough, you will find the source of minhagim in almost all sfarim. Today, it became a huge industry of chashava, good rabbanim, writing sfarim on a specific topic and showing the sources for a custom. When I started working on this topic, I found multiple articles that discuss potential sources. It's interesting. It's interesting that it says in this week's parasha, rather, that they hid Yosef. They sold him off, but they didn't tell Yaakov that they sold him off. Why did they sell? They didn't want to tell him. They had their 1,000 reasons why not to tell him. So they came to Yaakov to go through the process of mourning. What are you? They went through the process. And it says over here on 37, 34, Yaakov tore his clothing. And he placed sackcloth on himself, and he mourned so many days. It says, and his sons and his daughters, plural, they rose and they came to comfort him, but he refused to comfort himself. Yaakov was still in a state of mourning with a ewe for almost the entire time Yosef was not there. That's a 20-plus years. 20-plus years. So and the Gemara says, well, Rashi says right away, you know why it worked out this way? We have discussed many times the split screen, how the world works in a way that makes a lot of sense, but really God's orchestrating it to make even more sense. And Rashi here says, on 35, how come he didn't accept mourning? What is that? So Rashi says, I'll tell you why. Because there's a gzeira, there's a ruling, there's a, what's a rule or a gzeira? What word is in English? It's like a natural law, a natural law that a person does not accept complete mourning. Basically, it means he doesn't get over it if someone's actually alive and they think they're dead. So that we call mother's intuition. So if the person is really alive, then they don't get over it. So although normally it says on a regular mace, Rashi's quoting this from a Medrash, Gemara Pesachim, on a regular mace, it's a gzeira, it's a natural law that after 12 months, people start moving on. God created the world on purpose that way. People didn't move on, it would just be impossible. In fact, we discussed years ago, what is the reason why one of the reasons why you're not allowed to have any benefit from a dead body. One of the reasons was, they quoted by early commentators, because people had a custom that they would, in the old days, it wouldn't freeze, but they would do some type of freezing mummification in order to keep the dead person there, to keep the memory alive. And we don't want that. We want people to move on in life on a certain point. Not 100%, but yes, move on. So therefore, God made it that it wouldn't be so easy to keep the dead person plopped up on a couch. It would start having the natural process where it wouldn't be comfortable having a dead body there. So the question now became like this. So Yaakov couldn't, again, in this world, it makes sense. Yaakov wasn't accepting mourning. Why? So Rashi tells us that why he wasn't really accepting mourning. Not because Yaakov's a bad person, the law is, because really Yosef was alive. Yosef was alive. So if Yosef was alive, there couldn't be a mourning process. There couldn't be the final heel because in the end he was alive. The father's intuition was there. That's what Rashi says. So one of the most famous questions is, so then Yaakov should have realized. Why didn't Yaakov realize? Yaakov should say, wait a second, I'm not getting over this. I mean, the mother who's looking for her lost child, everyone says, get over it. She's no, I'm not getting over it. Why am I not getting over it? Because he's alive. I'm going to go look. I'm going to go. And then thankfully, sometimes they're proven correct. So here the question becomes, wait a second, Yaakov, if you weren't getting over it, I don't even know. Let's say Yaakov didn't fully understand it. There's two levels here. There's the mother saying, I know my kid's alive. I'm going to go look and prove him right. And there's Yaakov just not getting over it. So one, let's say Yaakov's not the first step. He's not saying, I know he's alive. Well, he believed it. But he should realize, wait a second, what do you mean I'm not alive? He should question his lack of getting over it. Right? Right? Again, the Gemara explains how reality in this world and reality in the next world makes sense. Yaakov wasn't getting over it. I'll tell you why he wasn't getting over it, because in the end, he really was alive. But then the question is, why didn't Yaakov think of this himself? A question asked, by the way, by commentators 400 years ago. Because it's on Rashi, right? They asked on Rashi. So one answer, brilliant, one answer is that there's a natural process that the world set up a natural way. God decreed upon us. There's like a decree. There's a decree in the world that people are going to pass away and on some level minimize the pain after a while, that people can go on and live a life. And it takes 12 months. So let's say now Yaakov's sitting here. He has 20 years. This is a brilliant idea. He has 20 years. So for the first 12 months, he's not getting over it. That's obvious why he's not getting over it. That's a normal situation. And now it gets to year, it gets to month 13. So the kids turn to me and say, your father, what's going on? So, or Yaakov himself should start thinking, why am I not forgetting it? So the answer is going to be that Yaakov convinced himself, you're right. For the first 12 months, it made sense. But you know what it was? He wasn't killed that first day. We found the clothing, the ripped, torn clothing, the bloodied clothing. We found it. Doesn't mean he died that second. Maybe he made it to a local hospital and he was in a bad shape for a while. So month 13, Yaakov says, you know why I'm not getting over it? Of course he's dead. He died month two. I'm still within the 12 months. That means Yaakov for 20 years convinced himself that he was always within the first 12 months. It means month one, month two, he was alive. Of course, I didn't forget. Yaakov says, well, I understand. Yaakov's saying like this, I understand there's a gzeira, a natural set of laws that someone forgets. You know why I'm not forgetting? In the beginning, I didn't forget because he was still alive. Of course, I couldn't forget. And why am I not forgetting now? It's 12 months, 13 months, 14 months, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, because he was alive the entire time until then, but he died within 12 months of now. So Yaakov was always convinced that he really had passed away, Yosef, and he's always within those 12 months. It's amazing. The idea is, the lesson we learn for ourselves is sometimes the answer is right in front of you, but your reality of being in a certain place, depression, unhappiness, whatever it is, doesn't allow you to think the good thoughts. You become your prisoner of your own thoughts. So even though Yaakov should have said, wait, this is great news. This is great news, I'm not getting over it. This is not bad news, I'm not getting over it. Great news, I'm not getting over it. Because that means he's still alive. But no, Yaakov convinced him, no, he had passed away, but we're always within the 12 months of when he passed away. Which means as long as he was alive, I wasn't going to forget, because he was alive. Month one, month two, year one, year two. Yaakov says, right now, you're right. Let me do this slowly. Yaakov is saying like this, right now, he is no longer alive. I am year five now, so let's get over it. He died within the year. So if I would travel back in time,
He still died 5 years ago.
because then I would have forgot about it. The moment Yaakov has to explain to the crowd why he's not getting over it. After 12 months, he's supposed to get over it. When the 12-month marker hits, The mind starts forgetting.
He's thinking himself, biologically, my brain should have gotten over it. Because it hasn't, that means he's still alive.
That means he was alive until within 12 months of now. Which means if I would superimpose and travel back in time to year two, he was alive, I was upset, I should have gone looking for him. Like the mother's always looking around. So Yaakov continues to think, imagine how a person's killing himself. He's killing himself thinking the entire time that my son was alive, I didn't go looking for him. Go now.
He keeps doing it.
But he keeps on doing it. But we'll say it's a lesson to us. It happens to be that the Sifsei Chacham on Rashi says brilliantly that this idea of the rule of life of 12 months was never known until Yaakov. That means Yaakov, until then, people never thought about it, didn't know whatever the words are going to be, or it wasn't actually implanted in the world yet. And after Yaakov's, it's hard to know what he's saying, but it seems like Yaakov's, this time of place is when it began. The proof that there's such a concept of forgetting was learned out of Yaakov. That means until then, people never realized it. People never thought about, oh, people die, we forget about them. People alive, we don't forget about them. It wasn't a concept that people were aware of. It wasn't so late, it was only 2,000 years into the world, and not, weren't that many people. People didn't know this idea that someone, after a while, gets forgotten about. And they learned that from Yaakov. Now, the point...
Another question.
That's one answer. There's other answers.
That someone was mourning too much for her son, and the husband says to her,
correct,
honey, you have to stop, or bad things are about to happen.
Correct. So that would be the...
Why didn't anyone go to Yaakov and say, you've got to stop?
Yaakov's answer is going to be, excellent, by the way. Yaakov's answer is going to be, I never went overboard, because he was alive until 10 months ago. So when you came to me 10 months ago, he was still alive. When you come to me now, it's because he died within 12 months. The story you have is when someone was 100% passed away, and they were over mourning a guaranteed death. So when someone is 100% passed away...
They went to the funeral, for example.
What?
They went to the funeral, for example.
They went to the funeral, they were there when they saw the body, yeah. When someone 100% passes away, there are rules of what the mourning process is like. And there is, and that story you're talking about that they say it about was Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach's married an only girl, not an only child, an only girl. They had a bunch of boys. He married an only girl. And Rav Shlomo Zalman, who was, we've discussed his midas, his character traits, were beyond comprehension. A person who they claim, I think I saw it many places, that at the funeral of his wife said that there is a custom at a funeral to ask forgiveness from the spouse, from the person who passed away. If it's not a spouse, people ask on their parents, people ask on their rebbeim. Anyone who gets up to speak at a funeral, till today almost, there's always a custom of someone saying, we want to ask the person who the recently deceased forgiveness for X, Y, and Z. We didn't treat you well. And almost 99% of the time, it makes sense what they're saying. And Rosh Mazama got up at his wedding and at his wife's funeral, and he said, I am not asking forgiveness. You know why? Because in all my years of marriage, I never did anything to ask forgiveness. That's how well I treated her. So, man, Rosh Hashanah was a humble person. You know the statement. She didn't die a week after they were married. She died decades later. Decades later. And it's brought down another unbelievable Rosh Hashanah story, that when it came into the Yichud room, Rosh Hashanah had no money. Back then in Israel, in Jerusalem, in 1908, you know what I'm saying? People starved to death. There was no collecting tzedakah for people. There was no... what do they call those things? GoFundMe pages. And there was no American money coming because in 1908 they had no pensions and people working 6 days a week. And people go into the room when they first get married, right after they get married, those first 15 seconds. And the custom in America now is you give a bracelet, you give something to the bride as like a thank you for being willing to marry me. A custom till today, what they give depends on what, nationality you're part of, whatever it is, you give something. And the legend was that Rosh Shlomo Zalman came in, he told her, listen, I don't have any money, but the custom is to give you something. So I'm going to give you something like this. Anytime there's a question of what we should do, me and you disagree, I give you right now at the wedding, my present to you is I always agree. I'm always going to go with your opinion. Now, I don't know if she was also a very wise woman. So she was the only child. Rav Shlomo Zalman told her, I'll give you everything. Rav Shlomo Zalman at the funeral said, I'm not asking forgiveness. And then when she passed away, this is the story, her mother was still alive. So she wasn't 20, but she was already an older woman. They produced a family of giants. Rav Shlomo Zalman has giant children. Rav Shmuel Orbach, who passed away, was, according to my Rebbeim, the greatest Torah scholar in the world at the time. That was his son, who passed away without children. In the Zera Emes Project, check out ZeraEmes.com immediately and sponsor as much as you can. But the idea goes that Rav Shlomo Zalman was, when he was so poor, he moved in the old days, what they do, the in-laws had to give something like a what they call a nadin for the daughter, marry my daughter. They give
a dowry.
In Yiddish, nadin. They would give a dowry.
What's the Yiddish word?
Nadin. That'd be Aramaic. Nun dalad yud nun. Well, I'm not spelling. A nadin, yeah, like a nadin. And so they didn't have any money either. This is Jerusalem 1906 or whatever, what year it was. So what they did was they, there were no really zoning codes then. They added a room onto their apartment where they said, yeah, you have this room. They built an extra room. That was his thing. They got an extra room, which meant you were being fed. They said for years, Reb Shlomo Zalman had it was the in-law's house. He never sat at the head of his own table. Reb Shlomo Zalman, the son writes that the entire world came to my father for advice on everything. Reb Shlomo Zalman was a giant on so many levels, it's worth giving 20 classes on him. We'll do maybe one now. The genius of him, the forward thinking, the unbelievable concepts. And they said in our house, he never said a word. Because he wouldn't say something in front of his father-in-law. His father-in-law says at the head of the table. His father-in-law's the head of the household. He wouldn't say anything. And then now we know also he wouldn't say anything because of his wife. So in his house, he was like a simple person, not say, of course, if they asked him, but he wasn't giving it, like we say today, everyone's an opinion giver. Today, in a 24/7 news cycle, everyone's giving opinions on everything. He didn't have that thing. He didn't have that thing. Reb Shlomo Zalman was so original that when the electricity came out, this is when he became mamash famous. When the electricity was coming out, there were different rulings. What is electricity? You expect a rabbi to sit down who studies Torah, understands the brilliance of it? He sat down and he started going through. He's an halachic genius, besides being a big Rosh Yeshiva. And he analyzed through doctors. He did this on everything, by the way, on in vitro fertilization, on all medical issues. He was the leading person. A guy who sat in Torah and never went to elementary school, what we would call elementary school, became the expert in these things. And wrote a book. One of his first svarim was on electricity. Because they weren't sure, what is electricity? I'm now in 2025. I can't define what electricity is. I have no idea. I have no idea why electricity works to know if it'll be. I know we don't turn a light on Shabbos. Okay, I know we don't use electricity on Shabbos.
Parts of an atom.
Parts of something. What exactly is occurring? He was a man. He was so forward-thinking. As a friend of mine once told me, a great line. In Torah study, what we do is we build off the previous generations. We build off of them. We take their ideas and we go a step further. That's the brilliance of what it is. Not easy. And you come with new ideas, or you match the new idea into one of the old ideas. When it came to electricity, he had to start with a blank page. There's no such thing in the history of the world of electricity until electricity
It's
came out.
Lightning.
Okay, so they had it all figured out now. That a harness, but nobody harnessed lightning to know what to do with it. Right? No, there wasn't a practical law about what to do with lightning. You make a blessing when you see lightning. That was about it, and avoid it at all costs. Two rules: avoid and make the blessing. But so here he opened it up, and then he went through everything: the laws of Shabbos, the laws of Yom Tov. There were certain rabbis who held that on Shabbos it was not allowed, but on Yom Tov it is, just like we cook on Yom Tov. And he went through, and he did this with every medical thing. He was such a forward thinker, such a forward thinker. And here
he
it was.
Sent to his mother-in-law when the
Oh,
daughter.
but when the daughter passed away, she was the only daughter, and they lived together. They must have been extremely close for all those years, and she was unconsolable. Parent losing a child, unconsolable. And it says at a certain point, after the 30-day marker,
Not the 12 months, but the 30 day.
for a child, there's no 12 months on a child. 12 months is only for a parent. We did that a few weeks ago here.
Too long.
Not for a sibling. Very interesting what you're saying.
Too long.
Maybe one day we'll discuss that.
Because you love your child much more than you love your
Correct.
parent.
It could be, by the way, I'm making something on the spot because of Yaakov right
Is that
now.
true?
Full circle. Maybe that's the reason why the Torah stops it at a certain point. Maybe the Torah feels, I'm making this up. Maybe the Torah feels if I give you 12 months, it'll never end. And by a parent, it's the natural way that the world goes. In fact, we know coming up in a couple of weeks that when Yehuda approaches Yosef to get back Binyamin, so the story is what? Yosef planted the fake thing in the sack and then he grabs Binyamin, okay, I'm going to take this guy. And Yehuda steps up and says, we're not going to allow this. And he says, I can't do this. Why? If I go back to the father, if I go back to his father, he's going to say, where's Binyamin? Where's my kid? Where's my kid? What do we do here? And amazingly, when you go through the psukim, and you read the history, at this point in time, we picture in our mind from the movies that Binyamin was a little kid and they put in a sack. Binyamin at this point might have 10 children. So even if you want to go with all the jokes that he got married young and they had kids in 7 months, not 9 months, Binyamin was 10 kids. So the question one of the great rabbis asked 100 years ago, why did Yehuda say, what would be more impressive? That I walk back in and his father's going to be upset without the kid? Or there are 10 orphans in the house we got to feed. Don't keep this guy, there's 10 orphans. Why did he say the father? So the famous concept was because a father losing one kid is 10 times more than the parent than the 10 kids losing the parent. Whatever, 10 times more. I do the math. The 10 children can handle the one parent loss, and a one parent can't handle the one child loss. You're right. So it could be there is a concept. So that because it's so difficult, the laws for a child are less. Very possible. It also could be that there's a concept of respect in the Hilchos, the laws of respecting parents. It's not really the mourning process.
Fourth commandment. What is the fifth
Right.
commandment? Fourth commandment.
Fifth one. So it's not really a mourning process, but as much as a respect process. Could be that as well. So what happens is Reb Shlomo Zalman walked into his mother-in-law and he said this law that you said, listen, it's the 30-day marker, maybe it was a 7-day marker, We have to lessen the crying, or else bad things happen. So when you hear that story by itself in a vacuum, it comes out very cold, very cold. But when you put it in the vacuum of who Rav Shlomo Zalman was, who he was to his wife, what he was to what he felt toward his wife, then you realize, no, this is very impressive. He's going with the law. Rav Shlomo Zalman, we've discussed in the past, every movement, his finger, his eye, was based on 1,000 laws going at the time. There was no, I don't want to say, like no emotions involved. There were, of course, but it was all based on, okay, what does the law say? We were discussing this class, an amazing story one time. He was walking with a guy home, and the guy opened the door for him, and he said, no, you go in first. Don't open the door for me. And the guy went, okay, listen. So the guy went in first, and they go upstairs to the apartment, and when he opens the door to the apartment, he tries it again, open the door for the Rebbe again. So Zalman walked in. So the students who, some students were lucky when there are students with intelligence that they get to realize, oh, wait a second, something's off here. Two floors down, you didn't go in. Most of the time, the students were missing it. So they turned to me and said, Rabbi, how come downstairs when you open the door, you said, no, you open your own door. I open my own door. What do the great rabbis say? Don't do me a favor. I open my own door. But upstairs, you let them open the door, you walked in. So Shlomo Zalman smiled and he said, I'll tell you why. Because the law, tucked away law, by the way, that the law says that when you're a guest in someone's house, when they tell you something, you have to do it. You become a guest. Something else. He said, so downstairs, when I'm walking into the building, I'm not a guest. He wants to open the door for me. Why would I allow someone to open the door for me? I'm my own person. I don't need a secretary. I don't need someone helping me out. But when the apartment door was open and I was right there, I became a guest. As a guest, I have to listen to what he says. Now, this ties in actually to what we did with the Chasan Akala. At what point do they become the kings? But we'll get to that soon. But the idea was in Yaakov, the first idea, which is important to recognize, is to know that our minds sometimes overthinking things. That means Yaakov is overthinking the reality. He's thinking, he must have died within 12 months. Maybe he's not. Maybe go look for him. Rashi says that Yitzchak was aware of what happened in this week's parasha. He doesn't say because in the end, that's what's amazing about the story. In the end, it came out that Hashem agreed to the court case. And it says Hashem gave a cherem. It means excommunication. That no one's. It's not Hashem gave it. When the brothers got together and they made a deal, they made a pact, better word. They made a pact that God, when no one's allowed to say, excommunicate if you do. It said that Yitzchak and God agreed to it.
This is the first time anybody mourns.
No, we have Lemech. When Lemech killed his kid.
Grief. He's like, oh.
Right. Then we have the wives separated from. And we had a whole class on that, RabbiHavna.com. More than one. Lemech. You put a Lemech into the search. Lemech. You should be able to find a phenomenal share we gave about that. And by the way, we'll get back to. And there's other answers. Like, for example, some say that Yaakov felt that by righteous people, it doesn't work. The forgetting of the person, righteous people live forever, whatever that means, right? Even when they're dead, they're alive, a famous phrase, right? Afilu b'meisim kruim chayim. Even when they passed away, they're considered alive, through their Torah, through whatever it is. So Yaakov felt, again, going on that thing, they weren't sure of all the parameters of this natural law of forgetting somebody. They weren't sure. So Yaakov said, I'll tell you why I'm not forgetting. Not because he's still alive, but because a righteous person stays forever. Or Yaakov felt, there's another explanation, that Yaakov felt that when you're the cause of it, you don't forget. A natural person passing away is one thing. But Yaakov sent him into the lion's den of his brothers, or he sent him onto the field by himself. Whatever the reason, you could say, Yaakov felt he played a small part in it. But all of these, this is what we have to know the lesson of us, all of these are only reasons why Yaakov fooled himself. But in the end, we have to know our lesson today is, don't fool yourself. Don't overthink it. Sometimes the easiest answer is the answer, and sometimes in grief, in sadness, in blaming ourselves, we overthink it to the negative. And that's a problem in life. What we should learn from this parasha. Don't overthink it negatively. Sometimes recognize there's a good out there. It means that Yaakov should have realized this is the greatest thing in the world. Yosef's still alive. Yosef's still alive. But instead he's taking the negative of it and overthinking it. The being trapped in this misery. Being trapped in the misery, thinking, oh my God, my son is dead. How am I gonna get past this? Not realizing that, no, think logically, get past, you're not getting past this because he's still alive.
Years the brothers are seeing their dad and in misery,
right?
And didn't have Nebuah anymore,
correct?
And they all knew exactly the truth.
Well, half truth, it could be he was dead at that point.
They sold.
Okay, so wait. First of all, let's say what we discussed in the past. Also, at one point, he was in a jail cell in Egypt, which is not even called a jail cell, it's a pit in the ground. The word that the Torah uses is a pit. What do you think life expectancy in a pit in Egypt was, right?
It was bad in Oslo, so
yes. And there they survived 2 years. And we discussed years ago how long was Yosef in the pit for? Over 10 years, potentially. There's an argument. The Torah is vague. Well, let's go. We know certain things. We know he left, he was sold at around 17. The parasha begins when he was 17. And we know he's 30 in front of Paro. So those are two markers we have. We know part of the story. He was sold. He became a head of a household. The woman tried to seduce him multiple times, and then he was placed in jail, and then 2 years later, there's a dream. So we know the story, and we know the bookends of the timeline, but okay, it's still a 12, it's still 17 to 30, 12, 13-year gap. Are we having him mainly in the wife's house, in the wife's duress, Mrs. Robinson situation, or do we have it mainly in the jail cell? And you're not going to divide it based on words. You're not going to look at the Chumash, there's more words here. And there are early commentators. And many, there are early commentators that definitely say that that it was 1 year rise to the top. Slave to the top of the house 1 year. 10 years in the jail. And then an extra 2 years at the end of the parsha. An extra 2 years, whatever that means. And some say, no, it was 10 years top of the world. 1 year in jail. And then 2 years extra. So almost in jail was going to be, well, 2 years, we know for sure. And right, because he interprets the dreams at the end of this week's parsha. He's already in jail. And it's 2 years later. And then 2 years later, when he has a dream. So he's definitely in jail 2 years. That's the minimum. You can have it 2 years in 1 day, or you can have it 13 years minus 1 day. So that becomes a thing. And there are early commentators that discuss it. Why do you bring up the jail cell? So right, so they had no idea where he was. It's very possible that he didn't make it. They went looking for him. They weren't sure. In fact, at one point it says, Yosef asked, what are you going to do if the guy doesn't want to do it? And they said, we're taking him back dead or alive. I think that's the phrase, which means they understood there's a possibility he was no longer alive. I think, so. Look at that phrase.
Rabbi.
Yes.
Yaakov could not believe that Yosef was alive, because what would that say about his other sons?
Well, yes and no. We are reading the story from the outside. We recognize something here. It could be, I'm just saying what it could have been, Yaakov would realize his son's alive and say, wait a second, you guys found the cloth. And they could say, well, what do we know? We just found the cloth. He never made it to us. Or he made it to us and we'd send him home. They always have the plausible deniability that we just found the clothing. Again, me and you know the story, so we understand that, wait a second, that's not true. But doesn't mean that they knew the story. How'd you get the clothing? I don't know, some pirate grabbed the shirt off his back, or the animal was good enough to grab the shirt off his back. Right. So yes, it's yes and no. But again, if we're going with the point that Yaakov was not clarity thinking, so then clearly you could paint a story that would have them innocent, him being alive. Which, by the way, according to you, Roseanne, you are correct. That has to be answered anyway. When Yosef is now found out to be alive, at one point, that's there. What does Yaakov think occurred? So we discussed this many years ago, that it says that by Yechi, that when Yaakov got sick, Yosef came to him, and it says, Vehine. Hine always means behold, brand new thing. It said that when Yaakov came down to Egypt, Yosef of Rabbeinu Bachai says this, 1300s, he avoided being alone in a room at any point, because he knew that Yaakov, he was afraid that Yaakov might ask him what happened. And he didn't want to say it, because of Rosen's great thing, don't gain one son to lose 10. That was Rosen's line to me about 20 years ago. Don't gain one to lose 10. So there are definitely opinions that Yaakov never found out. Now, Rabbeinu Bachai is saying Yosef was afraid of it. The other Svarim say Yaakov never asked. Because, no, they don't say we don't. That's an American way of looking at it. He didn't want to know. They say because when it comes to knowledge, the only knowledge is what makes a difference in practically law speaking. And the history of what might have occurred might not have had a practical difference. It's just curiosity. In Judaism, we don't believe in curiosity. Something we discussed many times, by the way, that in Kelm, unbelievable one, we discussed this, that in Kelm, people would try to get into a place. Very, very difficult. These old Musi yeshivas, they would have a seder for 5 minutes a day at 3 a.m. Get up, get out of bed in the freezing winter in Russia or Poland, get fully dressed, come to the basic Knesset. There wasn't a dormitory downstairs with heating. Come there, open up a seder, a sefer, and learn for 5 minutes and go back to sleep. Completely giving over of everything. So when people didn't know they got in, they said, you come for a month, and then we decide if you could handle such emotional pressure. Not an easy place to be. And the test was, no one realized. The test was the rabbi at the end of the month would walk you back to the train station to tell you that, okay, it's time for you to go, that, you know, and we send you a letter in the mail, and in 6 weeks we send you a letter. And what they would do, they would stand by the train station, they would wait to see if the person, future potential student, would at any point do something we do 1,000 times a minute, based worse than the iPhone. If you would look down the tracks to see if the train's coming, that was the test you failed. Because what are you looking down to see if the train's coming? That doesn't help the train come at all. How many times does someone press on the street? Do those things even work on the street? Those press here to get a green light, whatever they says? Never. I don't think they even work. They're psychological, right? How many times do you press an elevator button? You press it once, the red light goes on. Then you press it a second time. How many things we're doing? In Kelm, the goal of the student was to be in control of just not only his hand motions, but his thought process. Don't do something without a thought process. So when you lean over, you fail the test. If this is a true story, you fail the test. Why? Because that means you have a thing that you're making a movement that has no point, no purpose. So it could be that Yaakov himself said to himself at any point, what is the point of me finding out how 20 plus years ago I found a bloody jacket? Now, I'm not saying nothing has a purpose, but it could be, I don't know how far it goes. Did Yaakov not know about the sale? Almost for sure by many commentators. That's for sure by many commentators. Some might disagree, but many for sure openly state he did not know. He might not have known the whole story of Potiphar being in the jail cell. He might not even know the sensational story that TMZ about the slave who tried to seduce the woman because they had a background. He might not know the story of the greatest dream interpreter of all time. He might not know these things. Possible. Because who cares? You're living in the now. You're living in the now. But that's when it comes to his when he's in control. When he's in control, he lives in the now. But when he thought his kid was had that situation, he wasn't thinking as clearly. Because the grief ruins the thought process of people. And it's not just grief, it's the boundaries you put upon ourselves, the anxiety that we have, which is, happens all the time, the peer pressure that we have all the time, the not wanting to go out of our comfort zone. Every one of us throughout the day is living in a prison. More than one key is locking that door, right? It's social pressure, anxiety, hate my parents, hate my in-laws, hate my kid, whatever it's gonna be, jealous of this person. You pick all the emotions that go on, all the emotions that go on. And every thought is through that prism of the jail cell, sadly to say, sadly to say. And therefore, when the greatness is handed to you, they don't even see it. We discussed a few months ago that now there's a big lottery ticket. That every time a big lottery comes out, I think it's like 900 million now. They'd say that, by the way, you should know how many tickets were sold of millionaire tickets that no one ever collected. Right now in New York City, there's a $35 million lottery ticket, something like that no one ever collected. Right? Can you imagine that guy walking the streets? He's like, I'm a failure. I'm a nobody. If I just had a little money and it's in your pocket, for whatever reason, you don't know. But all of these things apply to us as well. The power we have, the brain cells we have, the emotional things we have. We are walking lottery tickets, winning lottery tickets, but we don't know. Because we're in a jail cell with 15 keys. I don't want to look this way. I don't look needy. I don't want to look arrogant. I don't want to look like a schlemazel. That social, again, it's endless. Every book in the world. The billion-dollar business of making people feel good, which doesn't ever work. Billion-dollar book business. If you do this one thing, never works. I try those one things. Anyway, next week is Hanukkah. We will not have a class. And we'll pick this up in about 2 weeks, hopefully. God willing. God willing.
I just want to mention something to you
Yes.
about Nodin.
About what? Not in
Nodin.
dowry.
That my father said that his father and future father-in-law told him he was going to get Nodin.
Right.
He didn't
Oh.
realize he was speaking Yiddish.
Exactly. That's
Nodin.
great. You get nothing.
Yeah.
That's
Nothing.
great. Great one. I think we're keeping that on. Keep that on.
All
Keep
right.
that on. That's good.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you, Stephen.
You're welcome.